This is the best of a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this week we have a guest in studio with us to talk about birth, what it's been like giving birth in the United States. And we're going to talk about how we might be able to turn the tides and what's been the current medical model that has made childbirth absolutely terrifying for most women. So let me back up a little bit. When I had my first child 37 years ago, and nobody loves a birth story more than anything, right? It's like talking about your dream. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about my birth story. So my first daughter, I was in labor for 36 hours, and I had a midwife, and we were in the hospital. And I had decided once I got to the hospital that I really didn't really want to have the baby, and I had stopped my labor, virtually stopped it. And my midwife was great, and patient, said, go for walks, go down and look at all the babies in the nursery. And I looked at the babies in the nursery and told my husband, I think I want to go home because I definitely don't want to have a baby. And so everyone patiently waited as the process went along. And finally, at about the 36-hour mark, my midwife said, you're not going to have the energy to push this baby if you can even get to 10. So I'm going to have to call in the doc to do a C-section. And she walked out the door, and I turned to my husband. I said, I'm pushing the baby out now, like right this second. And he ran down the hall, and she came in, and sure enough, whoop, we're there. Two pushes, there's the baby. And everyone talked about, you know, why didn't you talk about the C-section hours and hours earlier? 10 years later, my second daughter comes along, totally different story. She comes in hot and heavy and intense and lots of pain, and it moves very quickly. And without a lot of conversation, I'm talked into doing an epidural. And that was awful. And I was still able to push my daughter out. It was all very quick. But I had no feeling afterwards for so long that I couldn't get up and walk with her or hold her. And it just was, it felt very rushed and very intense. My experience after that was wondering why. One, my husband couldn't stay overnight with me in the hospital the second child. With our first baby, we stayed in the hospital together. We got to hold her. We got to walk her all night. And then 10 years later, all of a sudden, he had to leave as soon as she was born. And I was by myself in a room. And it all felt very uncomfortable and stressful. And I wondered why it had changed so much. And I didn't get any answers, because what seemed to happen is that after my experience having a child, everybody was having these rushed epidural type of births, and then all of a sudden C-sections, and all of a sudden it seemed like everyone I knew had some sort of traumatic experience. And so I want to understand how we got here. And I found Dr. Stuart Fishbein, OBGYN, found him on Instagram, where a lot of information tends to flow. But he was talking about midwives. He was talking about the medical model and how it was causing fear and how women could take more control of their birth experience. And I thought, why isn't Dr. Stu Fishbein the main person that people go to get information about birth? So we're going to find that out today. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of the conversation after the show today by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find our Facebook and Instagram pages. You can leave me a message there if you'd like. You can also listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, or you can podcast our show by going wherever it is you get your podcasts, search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and we'll be there to listen to at your convenience. We're going to take a quick break, get organized for the hour, and come back and start our conversation with Dr. Stu Fishbein. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You're listening to the best of A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We can't take your phone calls today, but please enjoy this program.
You're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and welcome to the studio, Dr. Stu Fishbein. Dr. Stu, for this hour of conversation. I appreciate having you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Elizabeth. It's fun to be on radio. I don't get an opportunity to do old-fashioned radio.
You come with a great resume and history or experience of working as an OBGYN, board certified in 1989. Dr. Fishbein was a solo clinical practitioner for 36 years. In 1996, he founded the Women's Place for Health, a collaborative hospital-based practice for certified nurse midwives and obstetricians in Ventura County. In 2010, Dr. Stu left his hospital-based practice and joined his midwife colleagues in a community setting. Dr. Stu co-authored Fearless Pregnancy, Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. Was named three times the Doulas Association Physician of the Year and received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Doulas Association in 2008. Dr. Stu has also appeared in many documentaries, including More Business of Being Born, and I hope we can talk about those documentaries both today. Dr. Stu recently stopped his community-based birthing practice to focus on sharing his vast knowledge and expertise around the world, traveling, teaching, and lecturing. Dr. Stu also has a podcast with midwife Bliss Young, who's located in Santa Barbara. I don't even where to start, because there's so much that you know. So I'm going to ask you probably the elephant in the room question. When you went through med school, why did you choose to become an OBGYN?
Okay, well, that's a good question. And before I do that, I want to just respond a little bit to some of the things you just said, just to clarify. Because I'm no longer practicing anymore, I gave up my board certification a long time ago. And I'm now an associate of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, because you can't be a fellow unless you're board certified. I want to be clear on the bio. I don't want anybody to think that there's anything else. And also, if I hadn't been walking on the coattails of midwives since early in my clinical practice, I wouldn't be where I am right now. And the best thing that ever happened to me was actually sort of being forced out of the hospital and then switching over to working with the midwives that I had been supporting for 25 years prior. And taking their transports, because they have so much more wisdom when it comes to normal. Doctors are really good at women, pregnant women with problems, but only a small percentage of pregnant women have problems. Yet that's the prism by which they see all pregnancies through. Mm-hmm. What happened for me was, if people don't understand, when you go to medical school in your first 2 years, you're doing basically classroom didactic and some laboratory, you know, anatomy class, that sort of thing. In your third and fourth year, you do rotations on clinical services. You could do ear, nose, and throat. You could do internal medicine, hematology, surgery, OBGYN, dermatology. There's all the different specialties. And sometimes there were 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or 6 weeks long. And I had just finished my rotation on what's called hematology oncology, which is blood cancers like leukemia, lymphomas. And it happened to be a pediatric service. And for me, it was rather depressing. The little kids were having seizures. We lost a couple in my 6 weeks on that service. It's very hard to watch that. And my next rotation was obstetrics and gynecology, purely random. And I was up at 3 a.m. instead of pushing chemotherapy, I was up catching a baby. Mm-hmm. And for me, it just gave me more of an adrenaline rush, more of a oxytocin dopamine rush to be doing something like that. So at that age, you're very young, you're very naive, you're very enthusiastic, you don't know anything, and you're asked to make a decision that's going to affect the rest of your life. So I took a deep look at the different specialties that I liked. And a lot of people went into like radiology or dermatology because they paid well and the hours were good. But I didn't care about that stuff because I was young. I liked obstetrics because of the catching of babies, of course, but also because you got to do a little surgery, you got to do a little endocrinology, you got to do a little psychiatry, you got to do a little of everything in obstetrics and gynecology, and you got what I thought was most important for me was I wanted to be in one of the specialties that had longitudinal care. Longitudinal care is taking over care of a patient over time. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to be an ER physician. I didn't want to be a radiologist or pathologist because some of those people never even meet the patient. Right. But an ER physician may stitch up your injury and then you never see them again. Internal medicine, family practice, and OBGYN are the only specialties where you see people time after time after time, year after year after year. And I really like that because the relationships meant a lot to me. And I think OB tipped the scales because I did like internal medicine, but because I could do surgery and because of the great thing about catching babies and having patients that came to you that were young and healthy and usually left happy and healthy was very rewarding for me. So that's how I chose to do it. You don't think about the liability. You don't think about the hours on call or being up at night. And that's fortunate because if people thought about that stuff, no one would go into it anymore. Right. You have to be out of your mind.
And when you're young, you have the energy, I'm sure, to do those long hour births. And the older we get, the less time and energy we have, I would imagine, for that.
We do. And then the profession has changed since I started practicing in 1986. I finished my residency at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. And I was lucky because I was very well trained there. It was a different era. There was a lot of surgery going on. We spent 4 months at LA County USC Women's Hospital, which in the early 80s was the busiest hospital in the country. They were doing about 22,000 births a year there. If you break that down, that's 65 babies a day.
Wow.
So, and then we had a small team of interns, residents, and chief resident, and we were managing the floor. And essentially, it was see one, do one, teach one, that sort of thing. I don't think you can get away with some of the stuff that we got away with in those days because it was a Wild West sort of thing. But we saw everything, and we saw at least two or three breaches a day, and we saw at least two or three sets of twins a day, statistically speaking. And it became just a variation of normal for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we learned how to put forceps on, and we learned all the skills that make the obstetrical profession unique.
Mm-hmm.
Because there really isn't a lot that the average generalist obstetrician does in 2024 that another specialist couldn't do. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything they do. Well, pap smears.
Yeah.
GYN surgery can be done by GYN oncologists. They're the better surgeons anyway. They get much more training.
Mm-hmm.
Obstetrics can be managed by midwives, and high-risk stuff can be managed by maternal fetal medicine doctors.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an endocrine problem, you can see a reproductive endocrinologist or a medical endocrinologist. If you have cancer, you can see a GYN oncologist for that. So every subspecialty that there's so many subspecialties in obstetrics that the generalist obstetrician, the really only thing that I can say makes them unique mm-hmm. is being able to do a breech delivery, being able to pull out a second twin with something called a breech extraction, putting forceps on. And these are the skills that are not even being taught anymore. So it's very disappointing to me that we're going, that the people who train the future doctors that are supposed to care for the women of our country are not teaching them the skills that they need to give the women of our country the choices that they deserve.
Hmm.
And so they're skewing their counseling to run them down into a funnel toward cesarean section or induction, but something that's obviously skewed toward intervention.
That was what I was going to ask, is if they're not learning all the broad range skills, then it seems like that's how we got to this place of having high rates of C-sections. Well, and also about how births are being induced. Is that more for convenience for the doctors or for the hospital? I mean, I want to get there, but I want to back up. Ask about the history part, because when I talked about my own experience, how it did change so much, even though I had midwives for both births, the interventions by the hospital were so much more intense that 10 years apart. And I had my first child in 86, right when you came on the scene. How did it change over the course of your career? And how did we even get to a place where births had to happen in the hospital at all?
We have to go back to about the 1920s.
Okay.
Prior to 1920, about 99% of babies were born at home. And it's really interesting. If you walk around the East Coast in some of the major cities, you may actually walk past a brownstone that says the birthplace of Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not, you know, after the next generation of presidents pass away, all the future presidents, you're going to have to walk past some hospital where it says the birthplace of Barack Obama or any younger generation president. You're not going to have that history anymore. So what happened, again, this is a really brief synopsis. There are books written on this, but the American Medical Association, in conjunction with the Rockefellers, actually started the medicalization of birth, the hospitalization of birth, the vilification of the granny midwives and the traditions of birthing to bring people into a system that they then could control, that they then could sell their products to, that they then could have power over. It was, maybe there were some doctors early on that, that thought that this was a good idea, but I believe that for the most part, it was nefarious, that it was done with the idea of safety. But safety is always a canard used to funnel you down a path they want you to have. There's a famous French philosopher named Albert Camus who said the welfare of humanity is always the alibi of tyrants. And it's a very pure statement. Tyrants will always tell you they're doing it for your own good. And so this is sort of what happened. And so they took it over and they medicalized birth. I mean, I was born in 1956. And my mother was put to sleep with ether when she got to completely dilated, and I was pulled out with forceps. And everyone got an episiotomy, and this was considered normal. There was immediate cord clamping. Babies were taken to the nursery. Women were kept in the hospital for a week. The babies were in these little plastic bins. You've all seen the pictures where you, the dad's knocking on the window and goes, there's my kid. Right. But what were we doing? No other mammal goes through any of that sort of thing. You would never do to your favorite pet or your farm animal or a wild animal what we do to the human female. And it all began in, you know, with the medicalization of birth and the interventions and the idea that that shortening labor was a good thing. Well, it's a good thing for the doctors and the nurses. It's a good thing for the hospital to move people along. But why? And why are we putting forceps on people? Why are we, you know, why are we numbing them? Why are we immobilizing them? Why are we starving them? Why are we not giving them fluids? You're lucky if you can have some ice chips. You walk in the hospital, you're immediately treated as if you're a patient because you're asked to sign consent forms that talk about surgery and death. You're asked to go into the bathroom, change into a hospital gown and pee in a cup. You have blood drawn. You have your blood pressure cuff put on your arm. This is what you do if somebody comes in the hospital with a ruptured appendix. It's not something you need to do with somebody coming in with a normal bodily function. The problem is they got away from the idea because of the of just the technology overwhelmed them and the idea of a sterile operating room. Birth, they convinced the American women and families that this was normal. But why does birth have to be sterile? Birth isn't sterile. Birth is better off for the baby when it's not sterile. No, it's true. It's true that how you're colonized, the bacteria you're first colonized with sets you up for life with your microbiome and your respiratory tract and your gut, which is really 80% of your immune system is controlled through those two areas. And if you're colonized off the bat wrong, and then you can, and then you, all you have to do is look at the results. We are now probably the sickest generation of Americans. Children have a chronic disease rate or an autoimmune rate of over 50%. Autism went from a disease you'd never heard of before to now something like one in 18 boys. Some crazy, crazy number. C-section rates in the 1970s were 5%, with the rate of cerebral palsy being unchanged. Now the C-section rate is over 30%. That's a 500% increase in surgical birth with no concern for how what that does to the baby, the mother, and the mother's future babies. All they're concerned about is they got a live baby out. My job was done. Well done. And then they can move on because now the baby is, belongs to the pediatric department and the mother goes home in 2 days and we say, see you in 6 weeks. Okay. We spend more per capita on healthcare and maternity care than any other country. And we're like 40 somethingth in the world. And we have countries, the third world countries that are higher up on less maternal and neonatal mortality than we do in the United States. How do you explain that?
I just want to remind people, if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And my guest today is Dr. Stu Fishbein. He's an OBGYN. So if you want to find out more about Dr. Stu, look for Birthing Instincts, because that's how I found him. And we're talking about the history of and the current state of birthing in this country. And so what I'm hearing you say is prior to the 1920s, home births were the norm, and it was midwives or doulas or grandmas that were kind of shepherding along this process. And then it became medicalized. And now we've just amped up the medicalization of birth to the point of what I'm hearing you say is birth now is treated like a medical emergency, like appendicitis. Would that be a fair analogy?
Well, it's treated as a medical problem.
Okay.
You know, again, I used appendicitis as an analogy. When you come in, the same questions you're asked if you come in with a ruptured appendix, if you're still conscious, obviously, and you come in for in labor are the same questions they ask you. Mm-hmm. How many stairs do you have in your house? What did your grandmother die from? Do you have any tattoos, any piercings? So these are the questions. I mean, what difference does this make? You know, you talked about why things went this way. And obviously, if it's like in anything else, follow the money.
Mm.
All right. When people were giving birth at home, who made money?
Yeah, nobody.
You know, the doctor maybe got, you know, a small amount of money and maybe a baked chicken.
Yeah.
You know, and that sort of thing.
Right.
Or they bartered. That's what they did. There's no corporate money. There's no middleman making money from something like that. When you take it out of that and you bring it into the hospital, you now have control over it. And then you, as a business person, can make money off of other people's work. Now, again, we're not going to belittle and we're not going to dismiss all the advances in medical care. But we're talking about, in general, the healthy pregnant woman.
And the other thing that, how many pregnancies, because let's just break it down to stats. How many women can expect to have, or birthing people can expect to have a routine birth?
Okay. In the home setting,
mm-hmm.
first-time mothers will have about an 80 to 85% success rate at home,
okay.
Which means that that about 20% are going to go to the hospital. And of those that go to the hospital, about half are going to still deliver vaginally. They just needed an epidural and Pitocin, and the other half will get a C-section. So you have about a 10% C-section rate in primips in the hospital. With multips, which are women that have had at least one vaginal delivery already, like you, those women have about a 99% success rate at home.
Wow.
Now, you asked how successful will they be in the hospital setting. Everything's different. You're automatically going to drop a certain large percentage points of chance of success simply by the model by which you're treated for. Again, you're not allowed to act like a mammal. You're not allowed to move. You're not allowed to be, you know, mammalian birth is best when it's safe, quiet, and unobserved. And that's not possible in the hospital setting. You mentioned earlier, it's like, you know, birth was taken out of the home.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what else was taken out of the home in the last 50 to 75 years? Death.
I was going to say that.
Right.
Yeah. We hide those things.
It used to be that families saw birth mm-hmm. and families saw death. We've now sterilized it. And a lot of people go through their entire life never seeing a baby born other than on Instagram and never watch someone pass away.
Right.
Peacefully.
Right.
In the home with loved ones around them. Again, because I'm not being critical of the mortician industry, but think about it. If somebody dies peacefully at home, the hospital doesn't make any money. And then we've taken people from being buried like or cremated in a small pine box into these elaborate rituals, mm-hmm. which may or may not be relevant. And again, that's not relevant to our conversation. But what I am saying is that when you take things away from the home, somebody is benefiting monetarily.
And I wonder, and I understand the monetary piece as well. I wonder if the intentions are always good, like it's safer and people are going to get better care and, you know, trying to be modern, because remember going through the 1950s was the modern era. And the idea was that science was going to cure all ills in modern society. And so we saw that kind of movement, like maybe it's just because I'm hearing you say, no, there was some nefariousness to once we realized we could make money on it, then.
Oh, well, a good example of that would be baby formula. Breastfeeding is nature's design to nurture the baby that you just gave birth to.
Right.
And in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, there was a huge push by the pharmaceutical companies and the food companies, whoever owned them, Nestle and other people, to push Enfamil and Similac and formula on on not only American women, but the world. And, you know, it had to be mixed with water. And in some countries, water wasn't very good. And the idea that bottle feeding is better than breastfeeding, which was the advertisements in those days, that's what we were told. The fact that they came up with what I call stage one thinking things, where they brought things into play, mm-hmm. like bottle feeding, without thinking of the long-term consequences. Another one would be something like thalidomide, which maybe some of your listeners don't know. Remember thalidomide. Thalidomide was a drug that was used for hyperemesis in women in the 50s in Britain, and it caused limb reduction defects. Babies were born with flipper-like limbs and stuff. It was only on the market for a while, and they realized, but it should they have not known that before they gave it widespread? But this is history repeating itself over and over again. And then there's something called diethylstilbestrol, which was supposed to be used to prevent miscarriage or preterm labor, and it caused what are called Mullerian abnormalities, which are female anatomy abnormalities in the female fetuses of the mothers who got diethylstilbestrol, sterility, cervical cancers, those sorts of things. And so that came, and you know, there's histories of these things over and over again. They came up with something called the Friedman curve, Elizabeth. The Friedman curve was your labor curve. Mm-hmm. And they decided that all first-time moms should dilate at such and such a rate. Turned out it was about 1 centimeter an hour when she reached the active phase, which was at from 4 centimeters on. They've now since changed a little bit, but a lot of hospitals, the old habits die hard. Mm-hmm. And so in order to have a curve, you had to have points on a curve, and the points on a curve were vaginal exams. So we did a lot of vaginal exams, and if a woman fell off the curve below the mean, they thought that we should augment her labor. And so this would be, let's start Pitocin, let's augment her labor. But this is a simple math question. How many people are below the mean? Half. So we're saying that 50% of women, if their labor falls below the mean, they need to have some intervention. And that's probably one of the key reasons why the C-section rate began to rise from the early 70s. And another reason would be continuous monitoring, the wearing the belts that you go into the hospital. They implemented those belts universally without any ever doing a study that showed what their primary outcome would be, which was to lower the rate of neonatal death. That was the intention, and to lower the rate of cerebral palsy. Not continuous monitoring, not even intermittent monitoring, which is listening intermittently, has done either of those. The only thing that continuous monitoring has done is contribute to the rise of the cesarean section rate. And yet it's still pretty much standard of practice in every hospital everywhere. One, because they bought the machinery. Two, because it's a labor saver. Three, because they're worried about liability. They think this is going to lower their liability when there's no data to say that. But when you have administrators and risk managers who are running the hospitals now, making the rules, mm-hmm. and you have nurses and doctors who, for the most part, now are employees, mm-hmm. you've created a monster, mm-hmm. and there's no way to stop it, and there's no way to correct it unless the woman is well educated and either avoids the hospital altogether. And again, we're talking for those 80-85% of women who don't have a medical problem that the hospital needs to deal with. Or to go into the hospital well-educated and say, no, I'm going to decline that. No, I don't really want an IV right now. No, my husband brought me in some nice pudding and some honey, and I'm going to eat my pudding and my honey. All right. And that's what I'm going to do.
But you have to feel empowered is what I'm hearing you say, that how do we help people feel more confident in those decisions? And I just want to go back because you came into your practice in 1986, and I don't imagine that you are 89. I don't imagine that you started off your practice believing all of this. So what was your awakening to this other way of seeing things? I would imagine you did a lot of traditional birthings at the beginning. What changed?
That's an excellent question, and it wasn't an epiphany.
Okay.
All right. It was a slow process, and here's what happened. I came out of residency at Cedars-Sinai, very well trained in the medical model. I was an interventionist.
Okay.
I believed in inductions. I was the crazy guy at the end of the bed with putting your legs up in stirrups, covering your legs with blue drapes, and washing your bottom off with betadine for a vaginal delivery, dressed in a full hazmat suit, catching your baby immediately cutting your umbilical cord, showing you this beautiful thing that you just created, and then walking it across the room and setting it down in the warmer. This was what I was trained to do. And when I was a third year medical student and doing that rotation that inspired me, every single woman got what's called a medial-lateral episiotomy. Even if it was your fourth baby, you got an episiotomy. This was the way medicine was done. It was, each hospital had their own chairman, and the chairman set the rules, and everybody did what they were told. What changed for me was that when I came out, it was a different model. I didn't come out and get a job and a salary working for a big HMO or something. I came out to build a practice, and I shared space with other OBs, and I assisted them in their surgeries, and I occasionally covered them when they were on, you know, they're on vacation, and I covered some free clinics, and I covered some ERs, emergency rooms. That's how you built a practice in those days. But I was approached very early in my career by some local home birth midwives and asked if I would take their home birth transports. And I said, sure. I didn't say sure because I thought home birth was smart. I'm sure at that time, like most OBs, I thought home birth was dangerous because I didn't know. And when you don't know something, you fear it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. And I thought midwives were probably fringe. And like most OBs who think midwives are a lesser subset of the obstetrical profession rather than its own separate profession, midwives are experts in normal birthing, and they know more about it than most obstetricians do. That may be offensive to some obstetricians, but, you know, wake up. Mm-hmm. It's true. They do know that. So I began to take their transports, and every now and then they'd call me. Every now and then there would be a real trauma that had to come in. And that happens, and that maybe scares a lot of my OB colleagues, but most of the transports, 95, 99% of them were going to be women that just got tired at home. Mm-hmm. You know, their membrane's been ruptured for a long time, or they've been laboring and they stalled out at 8 centimeters and they just needed some pain relief and maybe a little bit of Pitocin. So they would come in, they get an epidural, we give them some rest, we let them rest for a few hours, and we'd start Pitocin. But meanwhile, the midwife would come in with them. This was way, way, way pre-COVID where you weren't allowed in the hospital. They would come with them because midwives are, they're your midwife for life. They're going to come with you. Even if you transfer, they're still not going to abandon you and say bye at the door. And so I would have time to sit with them in the lounge and hang out, and we'd be talking. And they obviously felt they could connect with me, and I was open to their communication, and I was really interested in how they could do what they were doing. How do you do that without an anesthesiologist? How do you do that without an IV or a pediatric team? I mean, how do you do that? And they would tell me what they took to birth and what that, and I would learn a little bit about it. And over the next 10 years, I began to become more familiar with the midwifery model of care. And after 10 years of being a solo practitioner, I started a collaborative practice with two certified nurse midwives. In a hospital setting, it was a different hospital than Cedars because Cedars didn't allow midwives in that era. So I was in Ventura County, just north of LA. And for 15 years, we had a really good practice going. The midwives took care of all the normal stuff, the annual visits, the well woman checks, the prenatal care, the normal deliveries. And if somebody had an abnormal pap and needed a colposcopy or had an ectopic pregnancy and needed surgery and needed a C-section or had a breech delivery, that would be something that I would step in. So it was a really nice collaboration. And the style of care was that the midwives gave every woman, at that time, I think we were only giving them 45 minutes for a prenatal visit. Now it's usually 60. But that was opposed to the way that I was trained, which is about a 6 or 7 minute prenatal visit. And you can't possibly do preventative care and deal with stress-related reduction and how's your relationship and how's your sleep and how's your diet. You can't do that in 6 minutes. You can't do what you can do in 60 and six. So we had really good outcomes. We had about a 7% C-section rate, and yet we took all comers. And the next the busiest practice in the hospital that I was working at had a 20-something, 25% C-section rate, which in those days was still considered fairly good. But it was 3 times higher than ours simply by the model by which they were caring. They didn't take any higher-risk patients than we took. So it was a different way of doing things. But after about 15 years – so that's how I transitioned. And then after about 15 years of doing that, so I've been in practice almost 25 years, but we were never accepted in the community. The medical community did not like us because we were different. Yep. We did things differently. And I would like to say it was an ego thing for them. We had better results than they did. We had happier clients than we did. Our patients wanted to go home 6 hours after they gave birth. Mm-hmm. And that pissed off the pediatricians who had to come in, you know, at 10 o'clock at night to send someone home. They didn't want to do that. And our clients didn't want to have epidurals, so it pissed off the anesthesia department because they had to be there, but they weren't making any money. Yeah. And no, then this is, I'm putting my spin on this, but this is after thinking about it for years. So eventually they decided not to renew my privileges, which they had the right to do. It wasn't because we had bad outcomes. We had, you know, quite frankly, spectacular outcomes. And so then I was forced to make a decision. And the decision was influenced by my local midwife community who said, Stu, just start doing births at home. And even after 25 years, Elizabeth, of supporting midwives and backing up, I had never been to a home birth yet.
And did it scare you still?
Yeah.
In the back of your mind?
The first few, I trusted my midwife community completely. Mm-hmm. And so they did all the work and I would just come. And the first few were actually my clients who were due after the date that my privileges were going to be no longer in tow. So they said to me, they said, listen, we don't want to switch doctors. We'll just come to our house. Mm-hmm. So they talked me into doing the birth at their house, which is what they always wanted. But I never had done that before. And they were beautiful and they were great. And luckily they were. I think if it had been a disaster, the first one, I think the history would have changed itself. But they weren't. And they were beautiful. And then I began to get bolder. And I began to say, well, if I can do normal deliveries at home, head down, why can't I do vaginal birth after cesarean? Why can't I do a hypertensive woman? I can control her hypertension. And if I can't, she can go to the hospital. Diabetics, the same thing. Then breeches, or maybe, I don't know if they're in that order. And then eventually twins, started doing twins at home. And we have papers published on that. People can find them on the Birthing Instincts website. On our home birth breaches, and our home birth twins is submitted for peer review right now. It'll hopefully be out this year. And our outcomes were great. And I learned a lot about twins that I had to unlearn from what I was taught. Mm-hmm. Because I was always taught breech or twins, scary, alarm going off. You know, C-section's the safest thing for that. That's actually not even true. Yeah. It was never true. But they cherry-picked papers that supported that model because it was easier for them and it made more money for the system to section women, all women with breeches. No, like I said, no concern for that baby, that mother's wishes, or that mother's future baby's health. They just decided that that's what they were going to do because it was safer.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Stu Fishbein, OBGYN, and author of Fearless Pregnancy, Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. Also the co-host of Birthing Instincts podcast, and my guest today talking about the changes in birth over the course, in many ways, of your life as a professional. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
You're listening to the best of a conversation with the reluctant therapist on KCBX.
Is a flower that blooms every hour. I believe in the power of love.
You're listening to a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett here with my guest, Dr. Stu. All right, Dr. Stu, I want to talk about some of the psychological aspects of childbirth. And what I see in a lot of the young women I work with is they have developed so much fear around their birth because they hear the horror stories, right? And see the Instagram posts of all the trauma involved with it, that they're terrified to get pregnant or to go through the birth process. And they immediately say, I just want to schedule a C-section and have it over with. So there's no joy in any of their experience. How does that impact the pregnancy and the birth when we've created a culture of fear?
Fear is probably the greatest emotion as far as motivation or lack of motivation, paralyzing. And for me, just to simplify it, doctors and residents and medical students are taught that birth is dangerous, that birth is a medical problem. The American College of OBGYN even states that in some of their guidelines, that pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition. And if that's the prism by which they're teaching their young doctors, they come out and they fear birth. And so what do doctors who fear birth do? They project that fear upon the women that they're caring for. So I think that, and then it gets propagated in the media and in TVs and movies and everything that you see, like you talked about. So we have this issue, but we don't even think about, again, it's a stage one thinking issue. We don't think about downstream. What does fear do to a mammal? And how does that work? Because let me back up for a second. If a mammal is in labor, and a mammal doesn't have the cortex that we have, so they're not constantly interfering with their primitive functions like we are. Our brain always messes things up. Like if, you know, we don't have to think about breathing or digestion, but if you have to give a speech, you may get diarrhea or you might hyperventilate. That's your higher brain screwing up your primitive, you know, lower brain. But a mammal in the wild, when they're in labor, they're not thinking about anything. They're in their primitive mode. But if a predator approaches or there's a wildfire or anything like that, a threat, the body's sympathetic nervous system goes into action and you put out adrenaline. Mm-hmm. Adrenaline does things like get you ready to run away, but it also stops labor. Mm-hmm. And the mammal then gets up and runs away. And only when it's safe does labor again return. This way in nature ensures the best chance of survival for the next generation. It makes no sense for a mammal to give birth when a mountain lion is 20 feet away. Doesn't work. So we're not any different than that. And so we have this fearful-based system where it's not surprising that we have a lot of dysfunctional labors. It's not surprising that we have, that these things lead to intervention. It's really, they're all interconnected. But what are we doing to our fetuses when they're sitting inside mom, mm-hmm. who is sending out cortisol and adrenaline rather than dopamine and oxytocin to bathe that baby as it's developing inside, mm-hmm. because it's communicating with its mother, whether, you know, it's not speaking to its mother, not in language, but it's speaking in hormones. Mm-hmm. And there's a beautiful symphony being played back and forth between mother and baby, mm-hmm. that the medical model often interrupts by fear, by epidural anesthesia, by medications and drugs and other things that the medical model is so quick to turn to. And so we are creating, and the baby's neurons are forming inside. Mm-hmm. And again, these are theories of the, you know, I don't know how you prove something like that, but a lot of us believe in something called epigenetics, and that you could take identical mice that are genetically identical and put them in different situations and their offspring will be different, even though they have the same genetic material. So it's the same thing here. We're creating, what are we doing to the amygdalas and the hypothalamuses and the pituitaries of our babies, our fetuses inside of us when we're constantly nervous? One of my pet peeves is like a maternal fetal medicine doctor, because they see everything as a nail and they're a hammer. They say things to women, and so do a lot of my OB colleagues, and sometimes it slips out of our mouths as well, that's frightening. Like at 20 weeks, they come in for an ultrasound and the baby looks perfect, but there's one little echogenic focus in the heart. Mm-hmm. So they say, you know, your baby looks perfect. And there's this little thing, which really doesn't mean anything in you because you've had genetic testing and it's fine, but I want to see you back in 6 weeks. So what is a woman thinking about for 6 weeks?
She's terrified.
Correct. It's like if I tell you, don't think about elephants. Okay. This is, and you know this. So they plant these seeds of doubt that then sort of fester and grow for 9 months. And then of course we're inundated with stuff in social media and from our grandmas and our mother-in-laws and stuff. Are they telling us about their experience? I mean, it's really interesting to watch the dynamic when the grandma comes in with the mom for a prenatal visit and you ask the mom a question and the grandma starts answering the question and talking about her birth. You know that's actually a little bit of a red flag that this is going to be a little bit tougher for this mama to get through this prenatal care in a way that she's going to have joy and happiness. So the fear is something that we have to start to get rid of. And it's hard because a woman, it's her body. Her body's changing. All these things are happening inside of her. And, you know, if she's not surrounded by a nurturing team, including her, you know, her partner, her family, and her care team, then that's a problem. And so one of the things I would tell women early on, even before you're pregnant, when you go see your gynecologist, sound them out. Don't just choose your gynecologist because they've been doing your pap smear for 10 years as the one who's going to catch your baby. Don't do that. Ask them these questions. Ask them about what they, you know, how they feel about birth. What's, you know, think that, you know, what do you feel about going past 41 weeks or 40 weeks or, you know, how many ultrasounds you think I'll need in my pregnancy? And you can start to sound these things out to find a supportive team. And I would always say to a woman, even if you want a hospital birth, try to find a non-hospital based midwife and at least have some prenatal care visits with them, because they will give you that 60 minutes of good preventative health care and reassurance that you might not get in your shorter visits with your doctor. And it's not your doctor's necessarily their fault. It's the system's fault. That's a whole complicated thing about reimbursement and about time and the overhead and costs of running a practice. It's very difficult.
When my daughter went through her birth, I was there for both of them, and I had to get trained as a doula because of the, you know, hospital protocol. But the first time through, and she wanted to do it natural, and she had a plan, and they had, you know, food, and they brought all the things that you talk about to make it this beautiful, you know, birthing room experience. In the hospital, it was a birthing room. But when things got really intense and really hard and painful, she started saying, I don't think I can do this. And her husband didn't want to see her in pain, so he would be very quick to, you know, say, let's get something in there. But because I was there, I was like, no, this is where we're supposed to be, and helped her walk through it. And so that experience, and then with my second grandchild, we had the same kind of dynamic between her husband and I being able to support her. But without that kind of team of support, she would have got completely medicalized just the minute she was uncomfortable. And so the other thing that makes me sad is that a lot of couples choose to do their birth alone, just the two of them. And I think that's another reason why they get kind of bullied into doing more medicalized things, because most young husbands don't know. They don't want to see their wife in pain. So they're going to be the ones saying, do something to stop it. And so I think that's another reason why home birth would be helpful, or to allow moms. My husband and I were actually both there for the first grandchild, and it was just this very relaxed, safe experience. And
now I'm going to say that you can't have a physiologic birth in the hospital. You can have a vaginal birth in the hospital. You can have an unmedicated birth in the hospital, but it's not going to be physiologic. Physiologic birth is where you're, like I said, quiet, safe, and unobserved. You're left alone. Mm-hmm. Midwives can do that because they act like little ninjas. And if you're laboring in your room, or maybe there's a tub, a birth tub or a shower or whatever else, which is a great form of analgesia. Part of the reason that epidurals are so popular in the hospital is because once you're in bed and immobilized, you can't deal with pain in the way that our bodies are designed to deal with pain, which is called the gate theory of pain. And everybody knows what that is. They've never just heard it described. It's where you bang your elbow. And the first thing that happens when you bang your elbow, besides probably saying a four-letter word, is you start to rub your elbow. And the reason you rub your elbow is because it feels better. But the question is, why does it feel better? It feels better because when you bang your elbow on the opposite side of your brain, there's a little mapping of your body called the homunculus, and there's a little area that starts to fire, and it's going ouch, 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 ouch. The minute you start to rub that elbow, all the little nerves around that one all begin to fire as well. And it sort of muddies the waters. Your brain can no longer pick out the spot that hurts that bad. And so that's the way we deal with pain. Same thing if you burn your finger, you run it under cold water. That doesn't make the burn less. Just stimulates all the nerves around the burn and makes your brain not be able to pick it out as much. So it's the same thing. If you're in labor and you can get rebozoed, which is like a scarf where you just shimmy their back, or if you get, you know, somebody squeeze your hips or massage your back, or you get on all fours or rock on a ball or get in the water, whether it's a shower or the tub, those things help you through that. You don't need to have the medicalization of birth. The hospital model doesn't support those things. Mm-hmm. So that gets me to the point where when you have a supportive team, and that's why people want to do home births sometimes. And that's why people want to do free births sometimes. And again, as a medical personnel, do I advocate for free birth? No.
Do what I is understand? Free birth?
Free birth is where there's just the woman and maybe her spouse.
Is it even a midwife?
No medical personnel.
Okay.
Right. And I can't advocate for that, but I actually can support it because I understand where it's coming from. And I think that as a person who really supports my ethical obligation to allow women informed information to make their own decisions. And then we're support, our ethical obligation is to support autonomy and decision making. The well-informed women can make that decision. And if she chooses to do that, then the legislature should freaking leave her alone.
That is challenge.
But part of the reason they choose to do that, Elizabeth, is because they've legislated out the ability of midwives to come to their home. There are many states where, the licensing requirements are so intense and they want what's called standardization of care. And standardization of care might be okay for canning peaches.
Right.
All right. But it's not okay for the individual person. There is no standardization of care. But doctors they don't like chaos. And so they don't care that they create their own chaos by their standardizations and by their regulations. But they want to control everything, and you can't control. These are weird analogies that I come up with sometimes, and they come off the top of my head. But I hope that your listeners understand that this is a really important way of looking at things.
But and also to have that sense of control over our own destiny, because you kind of cued at this comment about wanting to legislate what's happening with birth. Well, for women, that's the experience of every part of our lives is being legislated, right?
Right. No, it's autonomy and decision-making, right? All decisions.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Stu Fishbein. You can find Dr. Stu on Birthing Instincts, his podcast, and his website for a lot more information of his insights around birth and the use of midwives. And it's interesting listening to you talk about it, because I can tell you have to walk kind of this fine line as a trained medical professional. You see all the benefits of home birth and midwives and letting women or birthing people have their experience. But then you also recognize, yes, there are times where there are emergencies, and yes, there are times that we're happy that the hospital exists. And I think that's kind of something I experience as the reluctant therapist piece, is there's so many ways that I worry about the medicalization and the medical model around mental health. And yet at the same time, I also recognize that for 1% of our population, having medications makes a difference between having some life and no life at all. And so I walk that fine line. I don't want to destroy the profession, but I want to have people be able to make more wise decisions about how they engage in the professions.
We don't need a C-section rate that's climbing 35, 40%. England just gave out its statistics for last year. And England, everybody thought, had a really good system because they integrate midwives in it. And their C-section rate was 39% in the United Kingdom last year. Only 43% of women in the United Kingdom last year went into spontaneous labor. 57% either were induced or had a scheduled C-section. That's an insane number. It's anti-nature. It's antithetical to nature's design. And every time you mess with Mother Nature, there are going to be consequences, whether you see them immediately or you see them a year, 5 years, 10 years, or a generation or two from now. We are going to see it. And if we just looked at medical history to bring us full circle, if we look back, we would be able to do that. But there's a lack of wisdom, and the incentives are all wrong. Mm-hmm. If hospitals were paid more by insurance companies to do a vaginal delivery than a C-section, you'd see the C-section rate falling. You'd suddenly see being taught breech and a supporting VBAC back in vogue. But right now, the incentives are all backwards. And the doctors don't have the time to make, and the doctors are not even in running the system anymore.
Yeah, you could trust your doctor to have your best interests at heart. But as you said, and it's the same in the mental health profession, that once managed care and big pharma comes into it, then the therapist loses control over how they're doing their work with their clients. And so that's why, again, that fine line of I'm not anti-therapists at all. I'm not anti the work of the helping professions. It's that we no longer have control over how we do the work. And it sounds like you're, it's describing the same thing in the world of birthing. And so in our last minute or so, if you got to be the king of birth, what would you want it to look like for those birthing? What would you want the experience to look like ideally?
Well, I would want people to understand that birth is a normal function of their body. And you always get asked this question about home birth or out of hospital birthing is, what happens if something goes wrong? It's very rare for something to go wrong. And when it starts to go wrong, it doesn't usually go wrong suddenly. Like you don't see these emergent, this whole cascade of interventions at the hospital leads to a baby that decompensates and they rush you down and do a C-section. And they say, thank God you were here, because if you were home, this your baby would never have survived. And it's like they don't realize that they have no self-awareness of realizing that what they just did, they just started the place on fire, and then they want you to pat them on the back for putting it out. So there are things, obviously, there are tragedies that occur both at home and in the hospital. And I would tell you that there's never going to be a zero, a perfect safety record. It's not going to happen. I would like to see most women give birth out of the hospital. The problem is that we need the hospital for those 15% of women and those small amount, number of women that need to be transported for, relief, not for emergencies, but for relief. And for the ones that really need it, the premature babies, the ones with severe preeclampsia, the babies with anomalies, we need hospitals for those. But hospitals can't financially survive if they don't do the normal births as well.
Well said. My guest today has been Dr. Stu Fishbein of Birthing Instincts. If you'd like to find out more about Dr. Stu's work, look for his book that he co-authored, Fearless Pregnancy, Wisdom and Reassurance from a Doctor, a Midwife, and a Mom. Join him on his own podcast, Birthing Instincts. You can also find him on Instagram. And Dr. Stu, thank you so much for sharing this hour that went way too fast.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. You can send me an email to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Leave me messages there. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can also podcast our show by going wherever it is you find your podcasts. Search for a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Hit subscribe. Maybe leave a review so we can share the show with others. And as always, thank you for tuning in, supporting my community, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.